years old, he often made continental dinners. We sat down frequently to coq au vin, prime ribs au jus, and cotelette milanese with all the trimmings. His specialty, however, was Mexican food. He traveled across the border weekly to pick up condiments and other supplies that graced our table, as pollo en salsa verde and enchilada con carne. If Dolores had been a little less aloof, a little more earthy, she could have discovered that those ingredients were rife in her town proper, and Dad had no need to travel to Mexico to buy provisions. But she would not be caught so much as looking into one of the crusty Mexican mercados, let alone venturing inside its smelliness. And it also sounded ritzy to say, "My husband, Mr. Johnson, the naval dietitian, went over to Mexico to buy some things for our dinner." That goes over large with other ritzy people who go to the white area to buy artichokes. Dad spoke fluent Spanish, and since I had studied for a year, we were able to converse slightly. I believe that my talent with the foreign language was the only quality I had that impressed Dolores. Her mouth was too taut and her tongue too still to attempt the strange sounds. Admittedly, though, her English, like everything else about her, was absolutely perfect. We indulged in a test of strength for weeks as Dad stood figuratively on the sidelines, neither cheering nor booing, but enjoying himself greatly. He asked me once if I liked my mother. I thought he meant my mother, so I answered yes. She was beautiful and gay and very kind. He said he wasn't talking about Vivian. He meant Dolores. Then I explained that I didn't like her because she was mean and petty and full of pretense. He laughed, and when I added she didn't like me because I was so tall and arrogant and wasn't clean enough for her, he laughed harder and said something like, "Well, that's life." One evening he announced that on the next day he was going to Mexico to buy food for the weekend. There was nothing unusual about his pronouncement until he added that he was taking me along. He filled the shocked silence with the information that a trip to Mexico would give me an opportunity to practice Spanish. Dolores's silence might have been brought on by a jealous reaction, but mine was occasioned by pure surprise. My father had not shown any particular pride in me, and very little affection. He had not taken me to his friends, or to Southern California's few points of interest. It was incredible that I was to be included in something as exotic as a trip to Mexico. Well, I quickly reasoned, I deserved it. After all, I was his daughter, and my vacation fell far short of what I had expected a vacation to be. Had I protested that I would like Dolores to go along, we might have been spared a display of violence and near tragedy. But my young mind was filled with self, and my imagination shivered at the prospect of seeing sombreros, rancheros, tortillas, and Pancho Villa. We spent a quiet night. Dolores mended her perfect underwear, and I pretended to read a novel. Daddy listened to the radio with a drink in his hand and watched what I now know was a pitiful spectacle. In the morning, we set out on the foreign adventure. The dirt roads of Mexico fulfilled all my longing for the unusual. Only a few miles from California's slick highways and, to me, tall buildings, we were bumping along on gravel streets that could have competed in crudeness with the worst paths in Arkansas, and the landscape boasted adobe huts or cabins walled with corrugated metal. Dogs, lean and dirty, slunk around the houses, and children played innocently in the nude or near nude with discarded rubber tires. Half the population looked like Tyrone Power and Dolores Del Rio, and the other half like Akeem Tamiroff and Katina Paxinu, maybe only fatter and older. Dad gave no explanation as we drove through the border town and headed for the interior. Although surprised, I refused to indulge my curiosity by questioning him. After a few miles, we were stopped by a uniformed guard. He and Dad exchanged familiar greetings, and Dad got out of the car. He reached back into the pocket of the door and took a bottle of liquor into the guard's kiosk. They laughed and talked for over a half hour as I sat in the car and tried to translate the muffled sounds. Eventually, they came out and walked to the car. Dad still had the bottle, but it was only half full. He asked the guard if he would like to marry me. Their Spanish was choppier than my school version, but I understood. My father added, as an inducement, the fact that I was only 15 years old. At once, the guard leaned into the car and caressed my cheek. I supposed that he thought before that I was not only ugly, but old, too, and that now the knowledge that I was probably unused attracted him. He told Dad that he would marry me, and we would have many babies. My father found that promise the funniest thing he had heard since we left home. He had laughed uproariously when Dolores didn't answer my goodbye. And I explained as we drove away that she hadn't heard. The guard was not discouraged by my attempts to get away from his probing hands, and I would have squirmed to the driver's seat had not Dad opened the door and got in. After many adios and bonitas and espositas, Dad started the car, and we were on our grimy way again. Signs informed me that we were headed for Ensenada. In those miles along the twisted roads beside the steep mountain, I feared that I would never get back to America, civilization, English, and wide streets again. He sipped from the bottle and sang snatches of Mexican songs as we climbed the tortuous mountain road. Our destination turned out not to be the town of Ensenada, after all, but about 5 miles out of the city limits. We pulled up in the dirt yard of a cantina, where half-clothed children chased mean-looking chickens around and around. The noise of the car brought women to the door of the ramshackle building, but didn't distract the single-minded activity of either the grubby kids or the scrawny fowls. A woman's voice sang out, "Bailey! Bailey!" And suddenly, a clack of women crowded to the door and overflowed into the yard. Dad told me to get out of the car, and we went to meet the women. He explained quickly that I was his daughter, which everyone thought to be uncontrollably funny. We were herded into a long room with a bar at one end. Tables sat lopsidedly on a loose plank floor. The ceiling caught and held my attention. Paper streamers in every possible color waved in the near-still air, and as I watched, a few fell to the floor. No one seemed to notice, or if they did, it was obviously unimportant that their sky was falling in. There were a few men on stools at the bar, and they greeted my father with the ease of familiarity. I was taken around, and each person was told my name and age. The formal high school, "¿Cómo está usted?" was received as the most charming utterance possible. People clapped me on the back, shook Dad's hand, and spoke a rat-a-tat-tat Spanish that I was unable to follow. Bailey was the hero of the hour, and as he warmed under the uninhibited show of affection, I saw a new side of the man. His quizzical smile disappeared, and he stopped his affected way of talking. It would have been difficult to wedge errs into that rapid Spanish. It seemed hard to believe that he was a lonely person, searching relentlessly in bottles, under women's skirts, in church work, and lofty job titles for his personal niche, lost before birth and unrecovered since. It was obvious to me then that he had never belonged in stamps, and less to the slow-moving, slow-thinking Johnson family. How maddening it was to have been born in a cotton field with aspirations of grandeur. In the Mexican bar, Dad had an air of relaxation, which I had never seen visit him before. There was no need to pretend in front of those Mexican peasants. As he was, just being himself, he was sufficiently impressive to them. He was an American. He was black. He spoke Spanish fluently. He had money, and he could drink tequila with the best of them. The women liked him, too. He was tall and handsome and generous. It was a fiesta party. Someone put money in the jukebox, and drinks were served to all the customers. I was given a warm Coca-Cola. The music poured out of the record machine as high-tenored voices wavered and held for the passionate rancheros. Men danced, at first alone, then with each other, and occasionally a woman would join the foot-stomping rites. I was asked to dance. I hesitated because I wasn't sure I'd be able to follow the steps, but Dad nodded and encouraged me to try. I had been enjoying myself for at least an hour before I realized it. One young man had taught me how to put a sticker on the ceiling. First, all the sugar must be chewed out of Mexican gum. Then the bartender gives a few slips of paper to the aspirant, who writes either a proverb or a sentimental remark on the strip. He takes a soft gum from his mouth and sticks it to the end of the streamer, choosing a less densely covered area of the ceiling. He aims at the spot, and as he throws it, he lets out a blood-curdling scream, which would not be out of place in a bronco-busting rodeo. After a few squeaky misses, I overcame my reserve and tore my tonsils loose with a yell that would have been worthy of Zapata. I was happy. Dad was proud, and my new friends were gracious. A woman brought chicharrones. In the South, they're called cracklings. In a greasy newspaper, I ate the fried pig skins, danced, screamed, and drank the extra sweet and sticky Coca-Cola, with the nearest approach to abandonment I had ever experienced. As new revelers joined the celebration, I was introduced as La Niña de Bailey, and as quickly accepted. The afternoon sun failed in its attempt to light the room through the single window, and the press of bodies and scents and sounds melted to give us an aromatic and artificial twilight. I realized that I hadn't seen my father for some time. ¿Dónde está mi padre?, I asked my dancing partner. My formal Spanish must have sounded as pretentious to the ears of the paisano as "Whither goeth my sire?" would have sounded to a semi-literate Ozark mountaineer. In any case, it brought on a howl of laughter, a bear-crushing embrace, and no answer. When the dance was finished, I made my way through the squeeze of the people as unobtrusively as possible. A fog of panic nearly suffocated me. He wasn't in the room. Had he made an arrangement with the guard back at the pass? I would not have put it beyond him. My drink had been spiked. The certainty made my knees weak, and dancing couples blurred before my eyes. Dad was gone. He was probably halfway back home with the money from my sale in his pocket. I had to get to the door, which seemed miles and mountains away. People stopped me with, "Donde vas?" My response was something as stiff and double-meaning as, "Yo voy para ventilarme," or "I'm going to air out." No wonder I was a big hit. Seen through the open door, Dad's Hudson sat in lonely splendor. He hadn't left me after all. That meant, of course, that I hadn't been drugged. I immediately felt better. No one followed me into the yard, where the late afternoon sun had tenderized the midday harshness. I decided to sit in his car and wait for him, since he couldn't have gone far. I knew he was with a woman, and the more I thought about it, it was easy to figure which one of the gay señoritas he had taken away. There had been a small, neat woman with very red lips who clung to him avidly when we first arrived. I hadn't thought of it at the time, but had simply recorded her pleasure. In the car, in reflection, I played the scene back. She had been the first to rush to him, and that was when he quickly said, "This is my daughter, and she speaks Spanish." If Dolores knew, she would crawl up in her blanket of affectations and die circumspectly. The thought of her mortification kept me company for a long time. But the sounds of music and laughter and Cisco Kid screams broke into my pleasant, revengeful reveries. It was, after all, getting dark, and Dad must have been beyond my reach in one of the little cabins out back. An awkward fear crept up slowly as I contemplated sitting in the car all night alone. It was a fear distantly related to the earlier panic. Terror did not engulf me wholly, but crawled along my mind like a tedious paralysis. I could roll up the windows and lock the door. I could lie down on the floor of the car and make myself small and invisible. Impossible! I tried to staunch the flood of fear. Why was I afraid of the Mexicans? After all, they had been kind to me, and surely my father wouldn't allow his daughter to be ill-treated. Wouldn't he? Would he? How could he leave me in that raunchy bar and go off with his woman? Did he care what happened to me? Not a damn, I decided, and opened the floodgates for hysteria. Once the tears began, there was no stopping them. I was to die after all in a Mexican dirt yard. The special person that I was, the intelligent mind that God and I had created together, was to depart this life without recognition or contribution. How pitiless were the fates, and how helpless was this poor black girl. I made out his shadow in the near gloom, and was about to jump out and run to him, when I noticed that he was being propelled by the small woman I had seen earlier, and a man. He wobbled and lurched, but they held him up firmly and guided his staggering toward the door of the cantina. Once he got inside, we might never leave. I got out of the car and went to them. I asked Dad if he wouldn't like to get into the car and rest a little. He focused enough to recognize me and answered that was exactly what he wanted. He was a little tired and he'd like to rest before we set out for his place. He told his friends his wishes in Spanish, and they steered him to the car. When I opened the front door, he said no, he'd lie down on the back seat for a little while. We got him into the car and tried to arrange his long legs comfortably. He began snoring, even as we tugged at him. It sounded like the beginning of a deep and long sleep and a warning that, after all, we were to spend the night in the car in Mexico. I thought fast as the couple laughed and jabbered at me in incomprehensible Spanish. I had never driven a car before, but I had watched carefully, and my mother was declared to be the best driver in San Francisco. She declared it, at least. I was superbly intelligent and had good physical coordination. Of course I could drive. Idiots and lunatics drove cars. Why not the brilliant Marguerite Johnson? I asked the Mexican man to turn the car around, again in my exquisite high school Spanish, and it took about 15 minutes to make myself understood. The man must have asked me if I could drive, but I didn't know the Spanish for the verb to drive, so I kept repeating "sí, sí" and "gracias" until he got in and headed the car toward the highway. He showed his understanding of the situation by his next action. He left the motor running. I put my foot on the accelerator and clutch, jiggled the gear shift, and raised both feet. With an ominous roar, we leaped out of the yard. As we shook onto the shelf of the road, the car nearly stalled, and I stamped both feet again on the pedal and the clutch. We made no progress and an awful amount of noise, but the motor didn't stop. I understood then that in order to go forward, I would have to lift my feet off the pedals, and if I did so abruptly, the car would shake like a person with St. Vitus dance. With that complete understanding of the principle of motor locomotion, I drove down the mountainside toward Calexico, some 50 miles away. It is hard to understand why my vivid imagination and tendency toward scariness didn't provide me with gory scenes of bloody crashes on Risco de Mexico. I can only think that my every sense was concentrated on steering the bucking car. When it became totally dark, I fumbled over knobs, twisting and pulling, until I succeeded in finding the lights. The car slowed down as I centered on that search, and I forgot to step on the pedals, and the motor gurgled, and the car pitched and the engine stopped. A bumbling sound from the back told me that my dad had fallen off the seat. I had been expecting that to happen for miles. I pulled the handbrake and carefully considered my next move. It was useless to think of asking Dad. The fall on the floor had failed to stir him, and I would be unable to do so. No car was likely to pass us. I hadn't seen any motor vehicles since we passed the guard's house early in the day. We were headed downhill, so I reasoned that with any luck, we might coast right up to Calexico, or at least to the guard. I waited until I formulated an approach to him before releasing the brake. I would stop the car when we reached the kiosk, and I put on my sedity air. I would speak to him like the peasant he was. I would order him to start the car and then tip him a quarter or even a dollar from Dad's pocket before driving on. With my plans solidly made, I released the brake and we began coasting down the slope. I also pumped the clutch and the accelerator, hoping that the action would speed our descent. And wonder of wonders, the motor started again. The Hudson went crazy on the hill. It was rebelling and would have leaped over the side of the mountain to all our destruction in its attempt to unseat me, had I relaxed control for a single second. The challenge was exhilarating. It was me, Marguerite, against the elemental opposition. As I twisted the steering wheel and forced the accelerator to the floor, I was controlling Mexico and might and aloneness and inexperienced youth and Bailey Johnson Sr. and death and insecurity and even gravity. After what seemed like 1,001 nights of challenge, the mountain began to level off, and we started passing scattered lights on either side of the road. No matter what happened after that, I had won. The car began to slow down, as if it had been tamed and was going to give up without grace. I pumped even harder, and we finally reached the guard's box. I pulled on the handbrake and came to a stop. There would be no need for me to speak to the guard, since the motor was running. But I had to wait until he looked into the car and gave me the signal to continue. He was busy talking to people in a car facing the mountain I had just conquered. The light from his hut showed him bent from the waist with his upper torso completely swallowed by the mouth of the open window. I held the car in instant readiness for the next lap of our journey. When the guard unfolded himself and stood erect, I was able to see he was not the same man of the morning's embarrassment. I was understandably taken aback at the discovery, and when he saluted sharply and barked, "Pasa!" I released the brake, put both feet down, and lifted them a bit too sharply. The car outran my intention. It leaped, not only forward, but left as well, and with a few angry spurts, propelled itself onto the side of the car, just pulling off. The crash of scraping metal was followed immediately by a volley of Spanish hurled at me from all directions. Again, strangely enough, fear was absent from my sensations. I wondered in this order, was I hurt? Was anyone else hurt? Would I go to jail? What were the Mexicans saying? And finally, had Dad awakened? I was able to answer the first and last concern promptly. Buoyed by the adrenaline that had flooded my brain as we careened down the mountainside, I had never felt better. And my father's snores cut through the cacophony of protestations outside my window. I got out of the car, intending to ask for the policías, but the guard beat me to the punch. He said a few words which were strung together like beads, but one of them was, "Policías." As the people in the other car fumbled out, I tried to recover my control and said loudly and too graciously, "Gracias, señor." The family, some eight or more people of every age and size, walked around me, talking heatedly and sizing me up as if I might have been a statue in a city park and they were a flock of pigeons. One said, "Joven," meaning I was young. I tried to see which one was so intelligent I would direct my conversation to him or her, but they shifted positions so quickly it was impossible to make the person out. Then another suggested, "Borracho." Well, certainly I must have smelled like a tequila farm, since Dad had been breathing out the liquor in noisy respirations, and I had kept the windows closed against the cold night air. It wasn't likely that I would explain that to these strangers, even if I could, which I couldn't. Someone got the idea to look into the car, and a scream brought us all up short. People, they seemed to be in the hundreds, crowded to the windows, and more screams erupted. I thought for a minute that something awful might have happened. Maybe at the time of the crash, I too pushed to the window to see. But then I remembered the rhythmic snores and coolly walked away. The guard must have thought he had a major crime on his hands. He made moves and sounds like, "Watch her," or "Don't let her out of your sight." The family came back, this time not as close, but more menacing. And when I was able to sort out one coherent question, "¿Quién es?" I answered dryly and with all the detachment I could summon, "Mi padre." Being a people of close family ties and weekly fiestas, they suddenly understood the situation. I was a poor little girl thing who was caring for my drunken father, who had stayed too long at the fair. Pobrecita. The guard, the father, and one or two small children began the Herculean job of waking Dad. I watched coolly as the remaining people paraded, making figure eights around me and their badly bruised automobile. The two men shook and tugged and pulled while the children jumped up and down on my father's chest. I credit the children's action for the success of the effort. Bailey Johnson Sr. woke up in Spanish. ¿Qué tiene? ¿Qué pasa? ¿Qué quiere? Anyone else would have asked, "Where am I?" Obviously, this was a common Mexican experience. When I saw he was fairly lucid, I went to the car, calmly pushed the people away, and said, from the haughty level of one who had successfully brought to heel a marauding car and negotiated a sneaky mountain, "Dad, there's been an accident." He recognized me by degrees and became my pre-Mexican fiesta father. "An accident, huh? Who was at fault? You, Marguerite? Was it you?" It would have been futile to tell him of my mastering his car and driving it nearly 50 miles. I didn't expect or even need, now, his approbation. "Yes, Dad, I ran into a car." He still hadn't sat up completely, so he couldn't know where we were. But from the floor where he rested, as if this was the logical place to be, he said, "In the glove compartment. The insurance papers, get them, and give them to the police, and then come back." The guard stuck his head in the other door before I could form a scathing but polite response. He asked Dad to get out of the car. Never at a loss, my father reached in the glove compartment and took out the folded papers and the half bottle of liquor he had left there earlier. He gave the guard one of his pinchback laughs and descended by joints from the car. Once on the ground, he towered over the angry people. He took a quick reading of his location and the situation, and then put his arm around the other driver's shoulder. He kindly, not in the least condescendingly, bent to speak to the guard, and the three men walked into the hut. Within easy minutes, laughter burst from the shack, and the crisis was over. But so was the enjoyment. Dad shook hands with all the men, patted the children, and smiled winsomely at the women. Then, and without looking at the damaged cars, he eased himself behind the steering wheel. He called me to get in, and as if he had not been helplessly drunk a half hour earlier, he drove unerringly toward home. He said he didn't know I could drive, and how did I like his car? I was angry that he had recovered so quickly, and felt let down that he didn't appreciate the greatness of my achievement. So I answered yes to both the statement and the question. Before we reached the border, he rolled down the window, and the fresh air, which was welcome, was uncomfortably cold. He told me to get his jacket from the back seat and put it on. We drove into the city in a cold and private silence. 31. Dolores was sitting, it seemed, in the same place as the night before. Her pose was so similar, it was hard to believe she had gone to sleep, eaten breakfast, or even patted her firm hairdo. Dad said sportily, "Hello, kid," and walked toward the bathroom. I greeted her, "Hello, Dolores." We had long dropped the pretense of familial relationship. She responded briefly but politely and threaded her attention through the eye of her needle. She was now prudently making cute kitchen curtains, which would soon starchily oppose the wind. Having nothing more to say, I went to my room. Within minutes, an argument ensued in the living area that was as audible to me as if the separating walls were muslin sheets. "Bailey, you've let your children come between us. Kid, you're too sensitive. The children, or my children, can't come between us unless you let them." "How can I stop it?" she was crying. "They're doing it." Then she said, "You gave your daughter your jacket. Was I supposed to let her freeze to death? Is that what you'd like, kid?" He laughed. "You would, wouldn't you?" "Bailey, you know I wanted to like your children, but they..." She couldn't bring herself to describe us. "Why the hell don't you say what you mean? You're a pretentious little bitch, aren't you? That's what Marguerite called you, and she's right." I shivered to think how that revelation would add to her iceberg of hate for me. "Marguerite can go to hell, Bailey Johnson. I'm marrying you. I don't want to marry your children." "More pity for you, you unlucky sow. I'm going out. Good night." The front door slammed. Dolores cried quietly and broke the piteous whimpers with sniffles and a few dainty nose blows into her handkerchief. In my room, I thought my father was mean and cruel. He had enjoyed his Mexican holiday and still was unable to proffer a bit of kindness to the woman who had waited patiently, busying herself with housewifely duties. I was certain that she knew he'd been drinking, and she must have noticed that although we were away over 12 hours, we hadn't brought one tortilla into the house. I felt sorry and even a little guilty. I had enjoyed myself, too. I had been eating chicharrones while she probably sat praying for his safe return. I had defeated a car and a mountain as she pondered over my father's fidelity. There was nothing fair or kind about the treatment, so I decided to go out and console her. The idea of spreading mercy indiscriminately ought to be more correct. Spreading it on someone I really didn't care about enraptured me. I was basically good, not understood, and not even liked, but even so, just. And better than that, I was merciful. I stood in the center of the floor, but Dolores never looked up. She worked the thread through the flowered cloth, as if she were sewing the torn ends of her life together. I said in my Florence Nightingale voice, "Dolores, I don't mean to come between you and Dad. I wish you'd believe me." There, it was done. My good deed balanced the rest of the day. With her head still bent, she said, "No one was speaking to you, Marguerite. It is rude to eavesdrop on other people's conversations." Surely she wasn't so dumb as to think these paper walls were made of marble. I let just the tiniest shred of impudence enter my voice. "I've never eavesdropped in my life. A deaf person would have been hard put not to hear what you said. I thought I'd tell you that I have no interest in coming between you and my father. That's all." My mission had failed and succeeded. She refused to be pacified, but I had shown myself in a favorable and Christian light. I turned to go. "No, that's not all." She looked up. Her face was puffy and her eyes swollen red. "Why don't you go back to your mother, if you've got one?" Her tone was so subdued, she might have been telling me to cook a pot of rice. If I've got one, well, I'd tell her. I've got one, and she's worlds better than you, prettier too, and intelligent, and her voice keen to a point. She's a whore. Maybe if I had been older, or had had my mother longer, or understood Dolores' frustration more deeply, my response would not have been so violent. I know that the awful accusation struck not so much at my filial love as at the foundation of my new existence. If there was a chance of truth in the charge, I would not be able to live, to continue to live with Mother, and I so wanted to. I walked to Dolores, enraged at the threat. I'm going to slap you for that, you silly old bitch. I warned her, and I slapped her. She was out of her chair like a flea, and before I could jump back, she had her arms around me. Her hair was under my chin, and she wrapped her arms, it seemed, two or three times around my waist. I had to push her shoulders with all my strength to unlock the octopus hold. Neither of us made a sound until I finally shoved her back onto the sofa. Then she started screaming. Silly old fool. What did she expect if she called my mother a whore? I walked out of the house. On the steps, I felt something wet on my arm and looked down to find blood. Her screams still sailed through the evening air like skipping stones, but I was bleeding. I looked carefully on my arm, but there was no cut. I put my arm back to my waist, and it brought fresh blood as I pulled it away. I was cut. Before I could fully understand or comprehend enough to respond, Dolores opened the door, screaming still, and upon seeing me, instead of slamming the door, she ran like a madwoman down the stairs. I saw a hammer in her hand, and without wondering if I would be able to take it from her, I fled. Dad's car sat in a yard twice in one day, offering magnificent refuge. I jumped in, rolled up the windows, and locked the door. Dolores flitted around the car, screaming like a banshee, her face bedizened with fury. Daddy Bailey and the neighbors he was visiting responded to the screams and crowded around her. She shouted that I had jumped on her and tried to kill her, and Bailey had better not bring me back in the house. I sat in the car feeling the blood slip down to my buttocks as the people quieted and cooled her rage. My father motioned to me to open the window, and when I did, he said he would take Dolores inside, but I should stay in the car. He would be back to attend to me. The events of the day swarmed over me and made my breathing difficult. After all the decisive victories of the day, my life was to end in sticky death. If Dad stayed a very long time in the house, I was too afraid to go to the door and ask for him. And besides, my feminine training would not allow me to walk two steps with blood on my dress. As I had always feared, no, known, the trials had been for nothing. The dread of futility had been my lifelong plague. Excitement, apprehension, release, and anger had drained me of mobility. I waited for fate, the string puller, to dictate my movements. My father came down the steps in a few minutes and angrily slammed into the car. He sat in a corner of blood, and I gave no warning. He must have been pondering what to do with me when he felt the damp on his trousers. What the hell is this? He hunched himself up on a hip and brushed the pants. His hand showed red in the porch's cast-off light. What is this, Marguerite? I said with a coldness that would have done him proud. I've been cut. What do you mean, cut? It only lasted a precious minute, but I managed once to see my father perplexed. Cut! It was so delicious I didn't mind draining away into the plaid seat cushions. When? By whom? Daddy, even in a critical moment, wouldn't say by who. Dolores cut me. The economy of words showed my contempt for them all. How badly? I would have reminded him that I was no doctor, and therefore was ill-equipped to do a thorough examination, but impudence would have diminished my lead. I don't know. He put the car in gear smoothly, and I enviously realized that although I had driven his car, I didn't know how to drive. I thought we were en route to an emergency hospital, and so with serenity I made plans for my death and will. As I faded into time's dateless night, I would say to the doctor, "The moving finger writes, and having writ moves on," until my soul would escape gracefully. Bailey was to have my books, my Lester Young records, and my love from the next world. I had groggily surrendered myself to oblivion when the car stopped. Dad said, "Okay, kidderer, let's go." We were in a strange driveway, and even before I got out of the car, he was on the steps of a typical Southern California ranch-type house. The doorbell chimed, and he beckoned me up the steps. When the door opened, he signaled me to stand outside. After all, I was dripping, and I could see the living room was carpeted. Dad went in, but didn't quite close the door. And a few minutes later, a woman called to me in a whisper from the side of the house. I followed her into a recreation room, and she asked me where I was hurt. She was quiet, and her concern seemed sincere. I pulled off my dress, and we both looked into the open flesh on my side. She was as pleased as I was disappointed that the edges of the wound had begun to clot. She washed witch hazel over the rupture and taped me tightly with extra long band-aids. Then we went into the living room. Dad shook hands with the man he'd been talking to and thanked my emergency nurse, and we left. In the car, he explained that the couple were his friends, and he had asked the wife to look at me. He said he told her if the laceration wasn't too deep, he would be grateful if she treated it. Otherwise, he'd have to take me to a hospital. Could I imagine the scandal if people found out that his, Bailey Johnson's daughter, had been cut by his lady friend? He was, after all, a Mason, an Elk, a naval dietitian, and the first Negro deacon in the Lutheran Church. No Negro in the city would be able to hold his head up if our misfortune became common knowledge. While the lady, I never knew her name, dressed my wound, he had telephoned other friends and made arrangements for me to spend the night with them. At another strange trailer, in yet another mobile park, I was taken in and given night clothes and a bed. Dad said he'd see me around noon the next day. I went to bed and slept as if my death wish had come true. In the morning, neither the empty and unfamiliar surroundings nor the stiffness of my side bothered me. I made and ate a big breakfast and sat down with a slick magazine to wait for Dad. At 15, life had taught me undeniably that surrender in its place was as honorable as resistance, especially if one had no choice. When my father came, with the jacket thrown over the striped cotton uniform he wore as a naval dietitian, he asked how I felt, gave me a dollar and a half, and a kiss, and said he'd drop by late in the evening. He laughed as usual. Nervous? Alone, I imagined the owners returning to find me in their house, and realized that I didn't even remember what they looked like. How could I bear their contempt or their pity? If I disappeared, Dad would be relieved, not to mention Dolores. I hesitated nearly too long, What would I do? Did I have the nerve to commit suicide? If I jumped in the ocean, wouldn't I come up all bloated like the man Bailey saw in Stamps? The thought of my brother made me pause. What would he do? I waited a patience and another patience, and then he ordered me to leave. But don't kill yourself. You can always do that if things get bad enough. I made a few tuna sandwiches, lumpy with pickles, put a Band-Aid supply in my pocket, counted my money. I had over $3 plus some Mexican coins, and walked out. When I heard the door slam, I knew the decision had gelled. I had no key, and nothing on earth would induce me to stand around until Dad's friends returned to pityingly let me back in. Now that I was out free, I set to thinking of my future. The obvious solution to my homelessness concerned me only briefly. I could go home to Mother, but I couldn't. I could never succeed in shielding the gash in my side from her. She was too perceptive not to notice the crusty Band-Aids and my favoring the wound. And if I failed to hide the wound, we were certain to experience another scene of violence. I thought of poor Mr. Freeman and the guilt which lined my heart even after all those years was a nagging passenger in my mind. 32. I spent the day wandering aimlessly through the bright streets, the noisy penny arcades with their gaggle giggle of sailors and children, and the games of chance were tempting, but after walking through one of them, it was obvious that I could only win more chances and no money. I went to the library and used a part of my day reading science fiction. And in its marble washroom, I changed my bandage. On one flat street, I passed a junkyard, littered with the carcasses of old cars. The dead hulks were somehow so uninviting that I decided to inspect them. As I wound my way through the discards, a temporary solution sprang to my mind. I would find a clean or cleanish car and spend the night in it. With the optimism of ignorance, I thought that the morning was bound to bring a more pleasant solution. A tall-bodied gray car near the fence caught my eye. Its seats were untorn, and although it had no wheels or rims, it sat evenly on its fenders. The idea of sleeping in the near open bolstered my sense of freedom. I was a loose kite in a gentle wind, floating with only my will for an anchor. After deciding upon the car, I got inside and ate the tuna sandwiches and then searched the floorboards for holes. The fear that rats might scurry in and eat off my nose as I slept, some cases had been recently reported in the papers, was more alarming than the shadowed hulks in the junkyard or the quickly descending night. My gray choice, however, seemed rat-tight, and I abandoned my idea of taking another walk and decided to sit steady and wait for sleep. My car was an island and the junkyard a sea, and I was all alone and full of warm. The mainland was just a decision away. As evening became definite, the street lamps flashed on, and the lights of moving cars squared my world in a piercing probing. I counted the headlights and said my prayers and fell asleep. The morning's brightness drew me awake, and I was surrounded with strangeness. I had slid down the seat and slept the night through in an ungainly position. Wrestling with my body to assume an upward arrangement, I saw a collage of Negro, Mexican, and white faces outside the windows. They were laughing and making the mouth gestures of talkers, but their sounds didn't penetrate my refuge. There was so much curiosity evident in their features that I knew they wouldn't just go away before they knew who I was. So I opened the door, prepared to give them any story, even the truth, that would buy me peace. The windows and my grogginess had distorted their features. I had thought they were adults and maybe citizens of Brobdingnag, at least. Standing outside, I found there was only one person taller than I, and that I was only a few years younger than any of them. I was asked my name, where I came from, and what led me to the junkyard. They accepted my explanation that I was from San Francisco, that my name was Marguerite, but that I was called Maya, and I simply had no place to stay. With a generous gesture, the tall boy, who said he was Bootsy, welcomed me and said I could stay as long as I honored their rule. No two people of opposite sex slept together. In fact, unless it rained, everyone had his own private sleeping accommodations. Since some of the cars leaked, bad weather forced a doubling up. There was no stealing, not for reasons of morality, but because a crime would bring the police to the yard. And since everyone was underage, there was a likelihood that they'd be sent off to foster homes or juvenile delinquent courts. Everyone worked at something. Most of the girls collected bottles and worked weekends in greasy spoons. The boys mowed lawns, swept out pool halls, and ran errands for small Negro-owned stores. All money was held by Bootsy and used communally. During the month that I spent in the yard, I learned to drive. One boy's older brother owned a car that moved, to curse and to dance. Lee Arthur was the only boy who ran around with the gang but lived at home with his mother. Mrs. Arthur worked nights, so on Friday evening, all the girls went to his house for a bath. We did our laundry in the laundromat, but those things that required ironing were taken to Lee's house, and the ironing chore was shared, as was everything else. On Saturday night, we entered the jitterbug contest at the Silver Slipper, whether we could dance or not. The prizes were tempting, $25 to first couple, $10 to second, and $5 to third, and Bootsy reasoned that if all of us entered, we had a better chance. Juan, the Mexican boy, was my partner, and although he couldn't dance any better than I, we were a sensation on the floor. He was very short, with a shock of straight black hair that swished around his head when he pivoted, and I was thin and black and tall as a tree. On my last weekend at the yard, we actually won the second prize. The dance we performed could never be duplicated or described, except to say that the passion with which we threw each other around the small dance area was similar to the zeal shown in honest wrestling matches and hand-to-hand combat. After a month, my thinking processes had so changed that I was hardly recognizable to myself. The unquestioning acceptance by my peers had dislodged the familiar insecurity. Odd that the homeless children, the silt of war frenzy, could initiate me into the brotherhood of man. After hunting down unbroken bottles and selling them with a white girl from Missouri, a Mexican girl from Los Angeles, and a black girl from Oklahoma, I was never again to sense myself so solidly outside the pale of the human race. The lack of criticism evidenced by our ad hoc community influenced me and set a tone of tolerance for my life. I telephoned Mother. Her voice reminded me of another world, and asked her to send for me. When she said she was going to send my air ticket to Daddy, I explained that it would be easier if she simply sent my fare to the airline. Then I'd pick it up. With the easy grace characteristic of Mother, when she was given a chance to be magnanimous, she agreed. The unrestrained life we had led made me believe that my new friends would be undemonstrative about my leaving. I was right.